Okay. All right. It is Tuesday as usual, March 4th, 2025. I welcome everyone. Just returning from teaching a 5-day retreat. We have some of the retreatants here, I see. And as well as one of the teachers, I believe I saw Anne. Hello, hello. nice to be together, and nice to have everyone here. We are entering into the birthday era of the this household. My wife is this Sunday, Saturday. I get those days right. It's important on International Women's Day. It's my wife's birthday, and then I'm of course born on the Steph Curry, Albert Einstein, also known as Pi Day. So, not that anybody, I did already b receive a present from Reverend Freak Childs. Is he here today? I don't see him now. He sent me some New Age book and two refurbished golf balls. So, very kind. Gee, I'm not gonna, I won't talk too much beforehand. Yeah, it's always interesting. I know many of you have been on retreats, and to transition back, as a teacher, I also have a transition back, and accompanied by a bit of fatigue at times. We went to see the Oscar-winning documentary last night. If anybody watched the Oscars, it was about the destruction of Palestinian villages in the West Bank, and it was not something that cheered me up, I will say that. But it was truth, it was reality, and it's what we're seeking to understand. So. It's called No Other Land. If you're interested in seeing it, it's not yet available streaming. Apparently, none of the streaming companies want to, stream something that, might upset people. So, anyway, that's my way of brightening your morning. We'll work on brightening it through meditation, and maybe I will actually try to brighten your meditation. I have some, tricks up my sleeve right up here. Okay. Silliness. So it looks like we've, pretty much people have almost stopped arriving. I was going to say stopped arriving, then someone showed up. All right, let's begin with a period of meditation, and we usually do about 20 minutes, and then I will focus more on a specific Dharma topic. So, just settling into your posture, whatever that might be for you. The great advantage of Zoom is that we can sit or lie down or stand or walk with no self-consciousness. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze, turning the attention inward. And first, just putting your attention on the sensations of the body. Coming into stillness, we feel the body, even as we are apparently sitting still, we realize that there is the movement of breath, and further, there is just the whole life of the body, which is energy. The blood is flowing, the air is flowing, The nervous system is generating impulses. We may not be moving through space, but we are nonetheless moving. And having the sense of just settling, relaxing, letting any tension flow out of the body. Releasing the shoulders, softening the belly. And feeling the body breathing. And so this morning, we might experiment with cultivating a pleasant experience, pleasant sensations, pleasant mind state. Now, beginning by feeling the breath in the chest, the movement rising and falling, and then having a sense of expansion. As with loving kindness, when the Buddha says radiating kindness over the entire world, feeling the sensations of the body, the nervous system, as a bright, uplifting energy, breathing in. Opening, sense of expansiveness, awareness beyond the body. Thoughts may move through the mind, sensations, keeping a sense of openness, expansiveness, the bright rising energy. Breathing with this. This is not a grasping, but actually a letting go of boundaries. Opening. Allowing the underlying bright, uplifting energy to move through you outward, opening the mind, opening the heart. The in-breath uplifting, the out-breath softening, allowing. Notice when there is contraction. Breathe into and through that softening, opening, expanding, releasing. Feeling the body as a field of energy. Nothing solid. Letting go of boundaries. Awareness. Boundless, expansive. All right, good morning again. I have been doing a little writing, thinking about letting go, which is, pretty, in some ways, a very generic sort of topic, but also really, obviously, really central to the Dharma. And it's something that, as with many Buddhist teachings, they can sort of seem very simple on the surface, and then the more you probe into them, the more you find, the teaching on right intention starts with, so there are three forms of right intention. The first one is letting go. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as renunciation, but letting go. And the other two are loving kindness and compassion, or non-ill will and non-harming. And so it's interesting to apply that to other aspects, and particularly to some of the meditative aspects of practice. And first of all, effort. That effort should be guided by letting go. It's a kind of a counter to our ordinary way of thinking about effort. Concentration as well. When we think about concentration, we tend to think of it as sort of like an applied thing, something we're sort of leaning into and making an effort, striving to make it happen. But if we think of it as letting go, has a very different meaning, it takes on a different meaning, and we discover in meditation over time, usually takes a while, that indeed meditation deepens, becomes more serene, more stable through the process of letting go, not through the process of like just zeroing in on the breath and just holding on to the breath. So I think it's one way to think about how we arrive here is to look at the Buddha's path, because it culminates in this teaching of letting go. But where does it start? Well, the Buddha, in the story of the Buddha's life, we're told that he's living in this splendor and this luxury of a princely life with these, three different palaces, one for the hot season, one for the cold season, one for the rainy season. And, he's only served by women, young women servants. And, all these comforts. And, but he makes this choice to let go of that. And so the first question, I ask is, what motivates that choice? What motivates that decision? And because an important question to me is, why do we let go and how do we let go? If we buy into the idea that maybe it's a valuable thing to do, or we're trying to follow a Buddhist path, like, why should I let go and how should I let go? And the Buddha says, or the story of the Buddha is that he realized that everything he had was transient, that none of it was going to solve the existential questions of life, of the meaning of life, of some ultimate answer to life. So he had this insight into impermanence, and this was then his motivation to let go. And but that the thing then that I think that's combined, that impermanence, because impermanence is so often brought up as sort of like a key insight, but it's combined with an insight into suffering, because he realizes that there, if or dukkha, or let's say unsatisfactoriness, he realizes not only is all this stuff impermanent, but that it can't satisfy him. And so that's a knowing, but the experience of that is painful. Seeing that everything you've built your life around and everything that has been offered to you as making life worthwhile is empty and unsatisfying, that hurts. It's painful. And so this insight that this isn't going to work, I need to let go, is motivated by the insight of impermanence, the insight into unsatisfactoriness, and the emotional pain of that realization. And so he makes this decision. You know, he senses that, I think, that there's another way. And part of that is, you know, the classical teaching that of the four heavenly messengers, that he sees, you know, a sick person, an old person, and a dead person. The first three heavenly messengers, that's the impermanence and the dukkha. But the fourth heavenly messenger is a monastic or an ascetic. And he sees that, and he has some inkling, some sense that, oh, there's another way. And that person is striving. That person understands that luxury and comfort is not the answer, are not the answer. And they've chosen another way. I don't know what it is, but I think it's pointing. You know, again, he has the intuition. He doesn't know, but he has an intuition that it's pointing to something that makes sense. Because if this accumulation of wealth and comfort and isn't the answer, then maybe the opposite is letting it all go. And so the beginning of letting go happens. And as the story goes, he leaves his wife and newborn, and calls upon his servant Chana to ride with him to the border of Sakya, his home country. Gets off the horse, gives the horse to Chana. Takes off his robes, gives the, you know, everything that he has that's of value, gives it to Chana. Shaves his head. Takes on rag robes and goes off into the forest. And so this is the first great letting go. And he doesn't even realize at this point that what he's doing now will actually become his answer. That he, you know, that he sort of his initial impulse is the answer. And he, you know, then seeks out teachers. He finds one teacher who takes him through meditative states that the teacher says, this is it. That's all I've got. Why don't you teach with me? So he's offered two things now. First of all, he's offered this meditation as the answer to deep concentration state. And he's offered a position of power, of teaching as a teacher. And, you know, those are very alluring things. But he sees, once again, he has insight in that the meditation is impermanent. It doesn't solve the problem that he's trying to solve. And that taking this role, this power, will just be like recreating his, you know, worldly life as a prince. And it's not gonna fix anything. And so he's, you know, not just rejecting a position, but he's rejecting the opportunity to feed his own ego by becoming someone, you know. So he set off again, finds another teacher, goes through the same experience, just at a higher meditative level. Once again, letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go of power, letting go of meditative states as solutions. And so then he's starting to see, okay, letting go maybe is the answer. So maybe what I should do is let go of this body. And he essentially stops eating, starts to starve himself barely. They say that he's having down to a grain of rice a day, and his body starts to collapse. And he's with this group of other ascetics who have been following him. They seem to have like met him along the way and when he's with these different teachers, and they kind of view him as the person who's going to get it and then become their teacher. And they're kind of, yeah, this is great. This guy's going for it, But at a certain point, he realizes, that destroying your body does not free your mind. And so once again, now he lets go of an idea. And he's letting go of the idea. Interesting. What inspires that? I mean, he seems to be capable of enduring any level of suffering. And he says that in the suttas. There's a sutta where he says, there's nothing any ascetic can do that I haven't done. Nobody's ever taken it further than this. And I've seen the limits of that. So he has insight into the limits of asceticism. We could say that in his princely life, he saw the limits of luxury, those extremes, and let go of that. And then his ascetic life, he saw the limits of pleasure, I'm sorry, of suffering, of that, suffering alone, kind of like penance, it doesn't free you. So he's tried these two extremes, right? So now it's getting somewhere, right? And so then he lets go of that, which is, as I say, partly letting go of a belief system, which both all of this letting go implies letting go of some belief system, but particularly here, this is a very strong belief system, and indeed, the five ascetics who he's been traveling with think that he's failed because they believe in that system, and they're like, okay, well, when he takes food and takes nourishment, they're like, okay, he's not really on the path anymore. So they leave him because they're very attached to their belief system. So then hear the story of the Buddha. Now he's alone, he's let go of community, he's let go of teachers, he's let go of the any kind of external solution, or even a meditative solution. But he's so determined that he sits down, I'm going to just practice until I understand this. And then he has this breakthrough, which is, again, letting go, right? He doesn't gain anything. He lets go. He experiences the unconditioned. So the unconditioned nibbana, is that which is not it not created by anything. And so there's nothing to let go of. When there is knowing of nibbana, there is no clinging in that experience because it is something that's not, it's not possible to cling to that which is not created. So, I mean, that's the best I can say about that. I'm not going to try to say much about Nirvana, not having a lot of personal experience, but I feel like I have some sort of an understanding that might or might not be useful to anybody else. In any case, he comes out of this experience, right? And he says, well, and this great moment in the suttas where he says, I decided like what I've understood is too profound for it's and too subtle for anybody else to follow. And if I try to teach people about this, it will just become irritating for me. Just like trying to explain not self to somebody who doesn't understand not self. And so he has this moment of just, it's fine. Like, I'm going to let go of doing anything else. I'm just going to sit here. And then the sutras say that this Brahma god, Brahma Jati, comes and visits him and says, there are some with just a little dust in their eyes. There are some who are ready to hear your teaching. So he decides, okay, I'll go and find them. With his divine eye, he realizes that neither of his teachers, who were the first people who come to mind, that they've both passed away in the intervening time. And so then he thinks of the five ascetics, and he goes to them, and he gives this first teaching, the setting in motion, the wheel of Dharma. And this teaching is founded in letting go, and it starts. Although we think of it as, at least I think of it as being about the Four Noble Truths, it actually starts by talking about the middle way, which is talking about letting go of the search for pleasure or the ascetic path. And so the principle behind it is set forth immediately. That this is about letting go of of extremes of which we could say really are characterized by grasping. The reason we go to these, or the nature of going to extremes is grasping, grasping after pleasure, grasping after more power, grasping after more money, or grasping after more penance for myself, more extreme asceticism. You can hear Ajahn Amaro, in the Thai forest monk, who talks about his own striving on this ascetic path in his early monastic years, and eventually having this moment when he kind of let some of those ex the extreme, more extreme ascetic practices go, and Ajahn Sumedho saying to him, okay, finally, you figured it out. You don't need to, do these very strict monastic practices, just stay within the boundaries. But then when the Buddha lays out the Four Noble Truths, we see what he's talking about. He's not just telling us avoid these extremes. He's like, here's how things work. Our tendency is to try to create pleasure and get rid of pain. And in that process, we get caught up in this effort to control. And because everything is impermanent and unsatisfactory, we can't control it. And so we get ourselves into a cycle of suffering. I mean, it's not that, suffering is a strong word. It's, you can say that, like, just a cycle of unsatisfactoriness, that it's never quite enough, it's never quite right, or it's too much, and it's this striving, this efforting to find this place of satisfaction through getting something. And that thing might be a mental state, like a meditative state, or an object, or a position of power, or a relationship. It takes many, many different forms. But ultimately, he says there isn't anything you can get. And not only that, but your constant effort to get it is what really causes you. That's really where the problem lies. If you just stop trying to get stuff, trying to control stuff, trying to fix stuff, that's actually where the freedom lies. And and this is clearly, counterintuitive, not at all what society or culture tells us, or even what instinct or nature tells us. But, try it out, test it, and you find that, it's true. And so he gives us these tools, not so much to let go, although that's the what it leads to. He gives us tools for seeing things clearly. And he the because what made it possible for him to let go was that he saw how things worked. And it was like, I can tell you how things work, but what's going to really convince you is if you see it for yourself. So here's this method called mindfulness that's going to help you to see into your experience and see for yourself the truth of these Four Noble Truths. See for yourself the truth that letting go is the way, is the path. And you'll be able to watch for yourself the experience of clinging. You'll be able to see the impermanence. You'll be able to see the unsatisfactoriness. You'll see the grasping, the selfing. And then you'll be able to see the results of letting go of all that. And that's what's going to motivate you and inspire you and guide you. And out of that, then, opens the possibility of transformation. So I haven't, this is ostensibly a recovery-oriented group, and I haven't talked about addiction or recovery, but it's always so sort of apparent. I think it doesn't take any great effort to make the connection that the Buddha is saying that letting go is the path, and that is the starting point and the key point of recovery from addiction is letting go. And so we can see how this teaching applies to and answers the question, or at least attempts to answer the question of addictive suffering. So there you are. I will leave it at that. We have a few minutes left for anyone who wants to chime in or add anything, ask anything.
I'd like to chime in.
Okay, please do,
Hi, Kevin.
Tenzin. Hi.
Hi, everybody. This was wonderful. Thank you so much. And I'm doing pr at present another pass through my ninth step. There are things that I never let go of. And so to hear, and a lot of it has to do with things from early in my life and things 30 years ago when I was working somewhere and in yet another addiction, so I didn't pay attention, anyway, and something from when I was a babysitter, when I was 12, so it's been really, I'm at the beginning of this whole other pass through things from my early years. So I'll just say, I'll probably have more to say in the future, but it's really wonderful to hear about letting go in this context because I'm already experiencing some of that, like somatically even, So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's As they say, more will be revealed. And, this teaching this weekend, an amends that I never made kind of came up for me. And there's lots of them that can't be made. But, the eighth step, I think, for me, becomes kind of the backstop. We're entirely ready. It's kind of made the list, but like allowing it to be there and seeing it. And I mean, there's because maybe this is too much to say, but at the end of the day, we have to let go of the idea that we're going to repair everything, because we simply can't. It's just not in our power. Karma has, taken place. Actions have happened. There have been results, and there may be something we can do about it, but there may not. And one of the things we have to do is be able to live with that and let go of that control. So.
And maybe let go of a certain view about what we can't change. But anyway, thank you so much. Yeah.
And it's interesting sometimes too when we make amends and we find out that someone else's view of what we did is very different from what our view is of it. So there's a lot there. Forrest, hello.
Hi, Kevin. Well, great talk. Wonderful. Very relevant from where I'm at. One thing you referred to that I've spent a lot of time contemplating lately, especially from the Buddhist perspective, is the avoidance of pain and the grasping for pleasure. My perspective, it's kind of the different sides of the same coin. And my perspective, I come from traditional AA backing initial AA background initially, which was a lot of focus on, grasping or seeking pleasure. Right now I'm very involved in ACA and working those steps. And in the larger recovery community, especially books like Realm of the Hungry Ghost by Gabor Monte and stuff, there's a lot more focus on the avoidance of pain. And I see that a lot more in a lot of other 12-step rooms of people moving in that direction. And yeah, that's where I do find, refuge in the Dharma, if you will, they are the kind of the different sides of the same coin. And you refer to that, but I'm still trying to find the balance. I almost wonder if there isn't this maybe traditional Alcoholics Anonymous and literature, like the big book, was really about a lot big emphasis on the, grasping for pleasure, and there's like an overcorrection now that is just putting the focus on the avoidance of pain. So, if you have any comment on that, on those thoughts.
No, I mean, I think it's a good point, Forrest. That kind of a dance that, and that there isn't like a perfect middle way. The idea of a middle way as something that's a solid path is an illusion. I always like to compare it to the tightrope walker, who's walking over the tightrope is never just it isn't just walking straight. It's a constant correction, and so this is what we use mindfulness for, not to attain some perfect balance, but to we want to keep things, we want to keep from falling off entirely, right? So, keep things within parameters, that are workable. And so that, I had, an ice cream cone last night. It's like, okay, but I'm not going to do that tonight and tomorrow and the next day. It's like, occasionally, I have some ice cream, and if I'm a a food addict, and then I don't ever have ice cream, right? That's the parameters depend upon my own capacities and my own tendencies, and what's balanced for one person is extreme for another. So there, we can't really, to go by some regulations, doesn't tend to work. You have food programs that are very strict, and then you have, mindful eating on the other end, where it's like there's no rules, and one has to do their best, and maybe with the help of a wise friend or friends, to sort of find what works for them. So that's best I can do for you. I'm staying safely out of controversy by claiming, to have the answer. Aaron, hello.
Hello, Kevin. So I'm interested in acceptance and feelings. So I'm 1 year sober, and
Yay.
yay, nobody told me that once it all wore off, I would be overcome with these feelings from what the previous speaker was saying, trauma from, big trauma from a long time ago. So I had to seek out a therapist because AA, it does, having a sponsor and telling her what the trauma was, she was like, oh, you poor thing. It just didn't work. So anyway, it turns out my therapist was in Narcotics Anonymous. And a deeply spiritual person. And his prescription was to do a 30-day meditation course. I kid you not. So right away, I started across the street is a park, the desert, went up to a bench, and every day at sunrise did these stinking meditations. And then all of a sudden, there was like some change. I really started to feel like my skin melt into the, this sounds crazy, into the cosmos as I listened to the birds. And there was, it was so transformative. And I needed more, more than 30 days. And so, I tell my sponsor, and she's like, have you been reading the Bible or the big book? And I said, no. I've been reading about Buddhism. I started with Taoism. Anyway, to cut to the chase, so it took until about less than a month ago. For this reason, and I had 500, no, I had 300 justifiable reasons for resentment I carried around. Nobody could talk me out of it. But I started practicing radical, I think it was one of your podcasts or something, radical forgiveness or some, or acceptance or something like that, and did it every day for about, I don't know, less than 2 weeks. And I swear, this thing I'd been carrying around all these years, I just went, oh my God, she was only 14 when I was born. She came from the deep south and had to leave her house, all that stuff. But what is the connection between? Are we just supposed to play around with our feelings, get underneath them, deal with them? I know we're not supposed to ignore them. What, so what's your advice on that? Because it sucks to have to deal with them.
I think we're out of time, so
Ah! No, we're not.
and first of all, Aaron, thank you for sharing all that, because it's quite relevant. I suspect that a lot of people here relate to sort of getting a limited, that the 12-step programs have a tremendous value and there are limitations, and that's why I do what I do. And yeah, meditation doesn't always, but can have this really liberating impact and transformative impact. So that's beautiful. And so, as far as feelings, it's really it takes work, and it does involve acceptance, and it does involve mindfulness, and it does involve loving kindness, and learning to, I mean, the first thing we have to learn to actually feel what we're feeling, which I think certainly for me, and I think for a lot of people, and particularly in the addiction world, that in itself is a huge challenge to get clear about what we're feeling, because there's been a lot of avoidance to it, suppression of it, intoxication of feelings, fear of our feelings, big time. And so there's just a process first of just discovering them and then learning how to meet them with awareness and kindness simultaneously. And I would then add a third thing, spaciousness, which really then relates to the sense of self, and then this becomes really, a whole other, not just Dharma talk, but book or two, several volumes. But it's a lot of the work that I do, and a lot of what I teach is working with difficult feelings. Yeah, it's a process, and you're entering into it, and it sounds like you're doing really well. So just, keep at it, keep asking these questions, keep be careful, be kind to yourself. Don't overdo it. Like, okay, now that I tried that, I'll go on a 3-month silent retreat. That'll fix. There isn't a fix. There isn't, a final answer. It's a process of learning to live with and work with these feelings. Why do you think we were getting loaded all the time? Because we didn't want to feel what we were feeling. And so now, you take that away, and it's not like, okay, now I'm fine with my feelings. It's really like, this is why people relapse, essentially, that they, the reason they were using was to get rid of feelings, change them, and then all of a sudden they're feeling them, and they don't have the tools for it. So part of what we do today in this work, in this mindfulness work, is learn to work with and live with the feelings that made us use, made us act in addictive patterns. And so yeah, that's an important part of what this work is, and it takes time. So
Are you going to write a book about self and non-self? Because I'd like to read that.
and I am not, definitely not.
Because I don't get
You don't need to.
it.
Don't worry about it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kevin.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Aaron. All right, folks. Very nice to see people. If you're looking for me tonight, I will be in Napa Valley Insight. Yes, Debbie. Hopefully, I'll see you there. If anybody is in the North Bay of the Bay Area, you please come on out. It's a really lovely group. And, but I'll probably give the same talk because, I'm into recycling, so I don't like to waste anything. All right, you guys. Nice to see
Thanks. Thank
everybody.
you,
We'll
Kevin.
be back
Thank
next
you.
Tuesday. All right,
Thank you,
thanks.
Kevin.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That's pretty. How do I get out of here?
Thanks, Joe.